This is the Q Talk America Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the show. It's our third and final hour of this Tuesday night. We call it the end of the hostage crisis.
Yeah.
I'm Clayton McKee alongside Doug Wilkie, Marnie Ryer, Al Perkins. We've already been here for a couple of hours, and I can't imagine you've missed it. But if you'd like to listen back to it, you can go to QTalkAmerica.com and find our programming listed on demand for your listening and enjoyment. Also, it plays 24/7 on a continual repeat just to annoy you.
Wow.
On online, so you can subscribe to that feed as well. Also, if that's not enough, you can subscribe to it on iTunes, and it will then be forced upon you on a weekly basis, so you can get it alerted right to your phone, in addition to our YouTube channel. So many ways to enjoy us, and so much time to do it. And speaking of annoyance, here's Al Perkins.
Yep. So we'll start, by popular demand, we'll start with Aretha Louise Franklin,
yay,
who went home to Jesus on August 16th, very famous day. Babe mm-hmm. Ruth died, Elvis died, Madonna was born.
Wow.
Yeah.
Lots of birth and circle of life in August.
Yeah, August 16th. So there you go.
And isn't Prince, Michael Jackson, and Madonna all born 3 weeks
apart in the same region?
In the same year.
Yeah.
And it just occurred to me, she's the only one left
still alive. Yeah, still.
Sad.
Can't kill her.
No.
I mean, no one's trying.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think so.
Yeah. She's not drinking propofol.
She does drink tequila on occasion and ride around on a tricycle in a concert in South America.
But who doesn't, ladies
and gentlemen? Perfectly fine.
Yeah.
Willing to find appropriate medical.
Which is my favorite Madonna story ever, but we probably don't have time for that.
My favorite thing is, like, go get medical help.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, Aretha lived to a ripe old age. Began her career singing gospel church at the New Bethel Baptist Church in Detroit, Michigan, where her father, C.L. Franklin, was minister. In 1960, at the age of 18, she embarked on a secular career, recording for Columbia Records, but achieving only modest success. After signing to Atlantic Records, where we get... Oh, and his name's going to be up here.
Clive Davis? Wrong.
No, he's Arista.
Armageddon.
I always say his name wrong. Atlantic Records. So I get pissed off when somebody's playing a Motown night and they slip in Aretha Franklin.
Because it's not.
No, she is, because Atlantic Records had a stable of R&B. Stable probably comes off wrong, but they had like an array, a menagerie, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it. They had their own. They had Otis Redding. They had their own. They were known for their soul records. So they were known.
Yeah, I thought it was funny when they were showing all of the different, you know, tributes to her. They showed the live shot outside of Motown Records and all the people, and I'm like, wrong.
Yeah, she was never in Motown. Yeah,
no research.
Just because she's black and a great singer doesn't mean
not
she came from Motown.
And my little claim to fame with her is that the song that was number one on the week that I was born was Respect. So
I didn't cue that one. I'm sorry. I just
oh no no I wasn't one. One of the ones I did. So and one of my favorite stories that Carol King, and I need some kind of a towel or napkin.
Oh, okay. I'm going to share a story too.
She
hurt herself.
No, I just scratched myself. My skin's so fucking dry. So Carole King was hired with Jerry Goffin.
Songwriter.
You know what? I have to, before I give someone credit that doesn't deserve it, because she did write with different people. Yes, Jerry Wexler was the producer. Jerry Goffin was the writer, her co-writer. And they wrote Natural Woman for Aretha Franklin. They were commissioned to write her a song to be a hit, and song is called Natural Woman. That is, Carole King did not write the lyrics. She wrote the music.
Right, the music for it. But she's the one who always gets credited with it.
Right.
Solely.
Well, no, I mean, everybody knows Goffin and King. I mean, that's kind of the whole...
Right, but when you think of that song... No,
because she also sang
nobody
it
Nobody says,
Tapestry.
Oh, that Goffin and King song. No, they always say the Carole King song.
Yeah. Well, most people
she's
know that
more famous.
Right. But they were married, and they wrote... All of their songs are Goffin... Like,
average people might not know.
Yeah, but...
People like us know.
Us know. Yeah, that she had a writing partner in the Brill
My
building.
Dad didn't know.
I did. She had a partner named Jerry Goffin in the Brill Building. I was surprised, though, to find out that she wrote... music that Carole King wrote.
Oh, you
the
thought
music.
She was just a lyricist?
Yeah, but especially with a lyric like Natural Woman, you would think the woman
would write that.
Yeah, it would go with identity politics on this one. And it was surprising to find out that he wrote the lyrics gave them to her, and since they had it done, they did the demo with her trying to sing it the way she thought maybe Aretha Franklin would, and then they heard nothing back for ages.
That's a great story. They heard nothing back.
They heard
back.
Nothing back, so they thought, oh, she must not have liked it, and then they found out that they had a hit, and they were like, with what? They're like, Natural Woman, and they heard it on the radio, and they were like, oh my God.
Oh, wait, I thought she was called into an office. I thought she said they were called into an office to hear, and they're like, what the, what is this?
But it was, however they heard it, it was already
produced and done.
Produced, recorded, yeah. Released, and they were, so mm-hmm. whether they heard it on the radio or they got called in the office, yeah. they heard it completed, and they were like,
wow.
We didn't even know yeah. that she liked it, and they're like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
So there was a couple things that Jerry Wexler, the producer, put to it, and it just a great story. When it came time for Tapestry, where she decided to record all the songs that she and Goffin had written together. She wrote a little bit with James Taylor, too, here and there. She did it, but she had to do it her own way. She couldn't.
I love her version of it.
Yeah. Though. But what it, like.
It's beautiful.
And my woman I used to live with named Sue, she knew the Carole King Tapestry album. She wasn't familiar with the Aretha Franklin version.
Okay.
So when I played her for the first time the Aretha Franklin version, she was like, funny thing is, like, Carole King's song is about dusting. Aretha Franklin's about sex.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
And it's kind of like the I Drove All Night thing. Like, Celine Dion singing about the car.
I love that song.
Right. She's singing
Cindy
about the
Lauper
car.
Understands
yeah.
the lyrics.
Right. Yeah.
But
long and Roy Orbison.
She was named the Queen of Soul, like, by the end of the 70s. At the end of the 60s, I'm sorry. Chain of Fools, Think, Never Love the Man the Way I Love You, her version of I Say a Little Prayer that she stole from Dion and like made a whole different song. And then I have to go put my glasses back on. She was dubbed the Queen of Soul, proclaimed I Never Loved a Man the Way That I Love You, Lady Soul, Spirit in the Dark, Young, Gifted in Black, Amazing Grace, and Sparkle. Then she had problems and she went to Arista for the next part of her career. And they decided to chase after the missing Donna Summer link because Donna Summer was busy having babies and took some time off. So she wanted a pop audience. She didn't want to be just the R&B audience that had occasional pop hits. They're like, well, now there's this lane that's now open. So she went for pop hits and she worked with, it's Narada Michael Walden, I think, was the one that was just brought in and was like, you are going to have a hit. So they did Jump to It and,
Freeway of Love.
Freeway of Love, but her first one was so much fun. There was Jump to It and Get to It, Get on It. The fuck was the name of that song? But Luther Vandross got involved. Like, everybody, Get It Right. Jump to It and Get It Right. The thing, she just kept trying to have hits, and then finally she hit with Get It Right. But Jump to It, so many fun songs, and so many people got involved in that late 70s, 80s when she was going through that transition and trying to find an audience again, and she was like, I'm done being fringe. Like, I want mainstream. And she really did hit. She got her shit done.
Yep.
Well, I had to Google it because I had forgotten how long ago it was. She was 44 when she recorded the duet with George Michael. I Knew You Were Waiting For Me. She was 44.
Wow. And that was
really?
Part of...
Yeah.
Because he was Arista. Yeah. So that was part of Clive Davis trying to get all his artists to self-promote and get that cross between he wanted R&B hits, he wanted pop hits, he was trying to break the color barrier for all of them because Whitney Houston was breaking, she was playing on traditionally almost all white stations. Like, he wanted everyone to have that success. He didn't want them to be, this is the R&B part,
right.
This is this part. So, and so one of the things he did was using George Michael, and then unfortunately George Michael gave a blowjob in a bathroom, so his big thing was to pair him with, they did it with What's-Her-Face, too, Jody Watley.
He did Jody Watley.
But then later,
Whitney
Houston.
Mary J. Blige.
And they got shelled because of the blowjob in the bathroom. Like, that was his thing, was to get George Michael back in the mainstream, was to ride on. So anyway, there was all these things and all these music executives playing games with her. But now, and we're just playing, like, 100 R&B entries, 20 number one R&B singles, the most charted female artist in the R&B history, 77 Hot 100 things, Rocksteady, Call Me, Ain't No Way, Don't Play That Song You Lied, Spanish Harlem, which is my personal favorite, which you just heard, her version of Bridge Over Troubled Water, Until You Come Back to Me, that's what I'm going to do.
I love that song.
Such a gorgeous song, so much fun.
a Medal of Honor.
Yep, and she got the...
And the Kennedy Center honor,
and then she sang for Obama and Carole King and her tribute. But, I mean, just a great career. We have made a lot of fun of her, because when you've been around that long, you're going to have your hits and misses. And I hope you just were ready for the other one. I didn't have to tell you. The I Dreamed a Dream, the screaming one.
Oh, no, I was not at all. But
because we have, in the course of the last 6 years, had a lot of fun with Aretha losing her goddamn mind.
Yeah.
What in the hell is going on?
Don't we have him doing that on
know.
One of the shows?
Yeah, because until we found it, we had to go with him. What in the hell is going on?
So are we going to tell stories about Aretha?
Did you watch, I feel like you watched the same interview I did with Carole King and Reverend Al on Chris Hayes.
Oh, yeah, that so was right side.
So the story that I heard that Reverend Al told, which I thought was such a cute story, he said that a couple years, right at the end of the Obama administration, there was some jazz festival on one of the lawns at the White House. Mm-hmm. They were all outside. It was all done in tents, blah, blah, blah. Big concert. A bunch of people were there. Aretha was one of the people that was there. So Reverend Al was invited. He shows up and he sees, I believe the gentleman's name is Eric, who was her escort everywhere. He took her, he walked her everywhere. A large black guy who used to, well, I don't know how tall she was, but he looked like a large black guy to me. But anyway, he was there and Reverend Al sees him and says, "Hey, where's the queen?" And the guy motions to this tent. He said, "She's in there getting her hair done." So Reverend Al goes over and peeks his head in, and Aretha catches a look at him and he says, "Hey, queen, how you doing?" Again, she's getting her hair done, and she says, "Life is good. Aretha Franklin's at the White House. We got a black president, and I'm getting my hair done."
That is fantastic.
Great, I love it.
Thanks,
Obama.
Yeah.
I love it.
Cute story of her. Yeah.
Well, I have an Al Sharpton. Maybe it wasn't the same interview, but I love that he told a little more serious story, but he said that. And I love this about her. She did a lot of things with no publicity about them.
Oh,
right, right.
I never knew this. And she has a great. She had another one, interview with MSNBC about 5 years ago.
Well,
she
used to talk to Al all the time. So, she was on his show a lot.
And so he said that she never left Detroit. That was always her main residence. Mm-hmm. Even when the city went to shit, she was very loyal to Detroit. Mm-hmm. And then whenever they would do shows there. If there was like a sting or whatever, and Al said you always wanted to be with her because she always took everybody back to her house for soul food. That was like her thing that she did.
That's cool.
I know. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
And I know. It's so.
I like it.
And he also said that I thought this was great because I never heard anything about this, and she never wanted any publicity for it. In the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement, because I guess she was the big voice, learned all these things about her that I didn't know.
That's the part that gets very little
attention. Well, her dad marched with Martin Luther.
Of course, yeah. And that she said immediately when Martin Luther King was like, you know, we're out there, and she, you know, she was like, I can't, like, you know, I'm not going to, can't do what you do. So she did concerts for free and never – they never publicized that, but as a way to fundraise.
Right.
And he was like, "Well, how many can you do?" And she said, "As many as you need." And that was a huge thing for them, was that she, that was her way of raising money. So they would go to churches and stuff,
and she would raise checks.
Yeah, she gave so much money and help and support to the civil rights movement.
And wrote almost none of her songs. I don't know of any that she wrote. There's none that I personally know of that she wrote. So she did, and she was. Mm-hmm. She was with the better of the record companies. Like Motown was famous for just raping their employees and leaving them penniless.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she was with at least a better contract, but she didn't get the royalties for most of her songs. If
yeah,
didn't
the
use
songwriter
her voice,
gets it.
The songwriter gets it, and the publisher. So she didn't. Her money all came from performing. So to give up concert royalties was a huge. Part, but she did play her own piano and often did.
Mm-hmm. Did you see what Elton John's tweet about her was after she died? Oh my God, this is so cool. So we were talking about this. I think you and I were just talking about this, Al, that she was self-taught a piano player. So she didn't really like read music. You know, she wasn't taught the piano. But she had what it's very rare, 1 in 10,000 have. And I never knew this. She had perfect pitch. Mm-hmm. And so she could just knew what a key was. And good. Elton John's tweet, you know, everyone, they were showing all the tweets after she died.
Uh-huh.
And I loved his tweet. He said, she's great. You know, he said all the right things. She's great. She's the queen and all this. He said, but a very underrated piano player. He said, she is my favorite pianist of all time.
Oh.
That's saying something coming from Elton John.
Right.
It so surprised Carole King at the Kennedy Center Honors when she came up and sat down by
her. Right?
But if you
look on her face, just was.
Well, it wasn't that she was sitting at the piano. It was that she showed up.
I think playing the piano might have been a big part of that.
But like, go on YouTube, kids. If you've seen Aretha Franklin, she always played the piano.
Like, but Carole King said that she was surprised
that she played the piano.
She accompanied
herself at such a large venue might have been a surprise. Oh. But Carole King,
Aretha's always played piano.
Oh,
no, that's not what we were saying. Yeah. That she came out and just walk out and sing into a mic.
That she accompanied herself at the...
Yes. We're getting all excited about it.
And I love that when she walked out...
I was just going to say, because this is another thing. People know she can play piano.
No, right. Well, actually, that's when Al Sharpton met her. He was going to his friend Cecil Franklin's new house, heard a piano, found which room it's in, and that's when he met Aretha Franklin. She was 6 years old at a piano just playing.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's when he met her. But I loved on that Kennedy Center Hunters. She walked, the only bitch who could get away with it, walks out in a full length fur coat.
Which I was like, that's ridiculous.
Throws her purse on the piano.
And her purse.
I loved it.
Well, you know, and one of the things famously about her performing is she would make them turn off the air conditioning.
Yes.
She did not like air conditioning.
Oh.
And most people did not like performing with her because it was so hot under the lights. And then she would walk out in a fur coat because it was hot. It's winter. Yeah. Well, it's not really winter. I think they actually filmed the Kennedy Center Honors
in
September.
Fall. Yeah.
But she wears her coat, and she'll wear it on stage. And finally, she'll take it off.
But she gets warm enough.
But she doesn't like the chill of air conditioning and has never had it. And people will be like, I love to perform with you, but I can't.
Yeah,
right.
I'm not going to be on TV sweating like a pig. Right.
So you know what? That's why she wore the coat. She got warmed up finally when she was standing there, and she took it off and
takes sold
the rest of it. Here are songs that were written by or co-written by Aretha Franklin. Call Me, Daydreaming, Let's Get Away.
I did know about Daydreaming.
Rock Steady. School Spirit, don't know what that is. Spirit in the Dark, Since You've Been Gone, Think, and Who's Zoomin' Who.
I didn't know she wrote Think.
She wrote or co-wrote.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
I love that she wrote Since You've Been Gone, too.
Rocksteady.
Rocksteady's a great number.
Yeah. Wow. So another thing, this is a little more underground that I heard about her, not after her death. This was years ago, but I thought this was really interesting, and I want to ask you guys this, Al. Because there was,
I want to ask you guys, Al.
And Al. Well, it's a theory. Sorry. Just a theory that I have. But I'm wondering if there was something called, and the reason I'm asking you is because you know about her history of like touring and stuff. There was a thing in the '60s called, and this the Chitlin Circuit was when black artists would do Ike and Tina Turner. You know, they couldn't get a lot of mainstream gigs, so they just did the Chitlin Circuit in the South. And these are like roadhouses and this kind of shit. So this is I'm making this theory up in my mind, but they said that Aretha Franklin was notorious for even when she was super rich, when she was asked to do a gig, she demanded payment up front.
Oh, up front. And in cash.
In a cash. Oh, you know this.
Oh, my God.
In
a
big bag.
Yeah.
Like, and she.
Oh, my God.
And she wouldn't do it.
Right.
And if you didn't do it. And I thought, and we're talking big, important people, like, who you're going to get paid, right? I mean, so I
Barry
thought.
Barry Gordy's giving you the money.
Check is, you know, the deposit.
No, I'm just saying.
The deposit's going to be made, right?
Right, right?
But the only thing, that's a pathology, right? When it's weird like that. The only thing I can think of, do you think that came from, this is conjecture, but like maybe that in those old days, Al, did she have to do those kinds of gigs where maybe the
you didn't know if you were going to get paid.
The sketchy owner wasn't going to pay you?
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So you sing, and then they're like, "Yeah, fuck you," and then you're like, "And they're like, what are you going to go complain, black lady?"
Well,
Well, we decided to pay you $100 rather than $1,000. Back in the day. Yeah, I'm sure.
Okay, because
she's like, no.
I want
Riri's
going to
sing. You're going to give me cash now,
right?
And she would keep it on her. She would
keep it on her.
Keep it on her. She would shove. According to the stories I heard, she would then shove the cash
in
her bra and do the concert.
That's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing she famous she would not
I'm
perform
so glad you did this.
For segregated audiences.
Oh, well, that's fantastic.
She was always very much
that.
On. She would never would.
Yeah, she wouldn't go anywhere. She wouldn't play anywhere that was still segregated.
You know, ignorantly, because I just didn't. I had never studied anything about her or really paid attention. I didn't know that her dad was so incredibly involved in the civil rights movement.
I didn't really know that either until recently.
Yeah. When I saw that on with the tributes part, I was like, oh. Yeah. I mean, then there were certain things that I knew about her otherwise that made better sense.
Yeah.
But it was, I thought, wow, that's fantastic.
And it has been all over the news, obviously, since her passing. But I didn't know until this about the Jet magazine interview when the woman was arrested. Was it for protesting? And she put up the bail money.
It was
the black activist that was arrested.
Gina posted about that on Facebook.
And she, and the quote was another.
I love this quote.
Angela Davis?
Yeah.
Was that Angela? Yes. Yeah.
The quote, so, say the quote, it's great.
Well, and I'm going to paraphrase because I don't know that I have it exactly right, but it was basically, I have money, I got the money from black people,
that's right.
I'm giving the money back.
Yep.
It was so cool. She will be free, or something to the, something about freedom she threw in there.
That's so, so great.
Amit Erdogan was the head of Atlantic, he was that's the founder and head of of Atlantic Records, and he was the one that kept that Atlantic Records. So if, there's people that talk about like really loving classic R&B, and they always talk about like Berry Gordy was trying to make black artists sound white. He was trying to bring them over to the mainstream and have them get rid of anything that made them sound funky, where Amit Erdogan, who was going the exact opposite way and wanted them to
keep the funk, but we're going to promote
funk,
it.
Stay as true to you as you can. And like his list of artists is just
that is exactly right.
Amina just posted in the chat room that is so badass, singing with a fur coat and $5,000 in her bra.
That's
in her
bra. Which makes her so real to me. That's what I like about her.
Which made me think, because they actually talked about also like she would cash up front, whatever, and she carried her handbag everywhere. And I'm thinking to myself, did she throw that handbag down on that piano at the
with all the cash?
With $100,000 inside of it. Yeah.
I thought that was fantastic.
One last one before, I'm sorry,
no, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I hogged the whole segment, but this, and Al, was it the Academy Awards when she sang the, was it the Academy Awards?
The Grammy Awards. Where
Okay.
she stepped in for Luciano Pavarotti.
Yes. No. So I have got this story wrong the whole time, and it's in the MSNBC interview that she did with a white interviewer who I can't remember. I always assumed that when that happened, Pavarotti was either sick or couldn't make it and to sing it, and his was opera. That was the opera song that we all love.
He was under medical care, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he was under medical care. And so they didn't know what to do. I thought, I was under the impression that she said, that's okay, like, I'll do it. That's not true. So, Al, you can tell me if you remember this or not. They went to her. They couldn't get a sub, you know, in time or whatever. And she was going to be singing something else that night at the Grammys. So they actually went to her and said, we need you to do this part. And she, I thought this was very, very humble. She said, I can't do that. I'm not an opera singer. Like, I can't do that. I didn't know this. I had this story wrong. I thought she said, oh, no, me, you know, I'll
do it. That's what I would have assumed.
Yeah. No.
No.
So, and this is true because she was telling the story. And she said, I was blown away. And she said, I can't do that. I'm not an opera singer. And whoever the producer was said, you absolutely can do it. You're one of the greatest, you know, voices ever. And like gave her this pep talk. And this is the funniest thing. And then she said, what key? And then said, okay, I'll do it. Like, yeah, all right, you said how great I am. She, like, he built her up.
What key?
I'll do it. Yeah. Well, now that you've mentioned it, I can.
And then walked out and did it. She just needed some encouragement.
Yeah. Right.
So, well, that's one of my favorite memories.
And almost no rehearsal. With
zero. Wow.
She had the paper duet, with her duet partner. Her.
Yeah.
They, like, went through it. And she was the Judy Garland with that perfect pitch thing. Mm. And the fact that, like, couldn't classically read music, but if you set it there, she, you know, it's a roadmap. You know whether to go high or low.
Yeah.
But they had played it for her once, and she was like, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like Judy used to say, like, harmony, or where do you want it?
Yeah.
Like, I've heard it.
Yeah.
Right.
Stop playing it now. I'm good.
And did a fantastic job with it. It was one of those times you're like, all right, this bitch is for real.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah, it was one of those things where you're watching, you're going like, that wasn't even faking opera.
No. And I loved that.
There was a...
We need to find that on video.
She's saying, if I'm playing on the piano, I'm going to have my eyes on the cash the whole fucking time. Yeah. That's what she threw her purse on the piano. Because
if you watch... Miss Franklin, could I hold that?
I didn't show
you there. No.
And if you watch the clip, because there's a side shot when she walks to the piano, and she throws that purse down.
Her money.
Yeah, she throws that bag down.
That bitch got paid.
That's right.
And she just starts to play.
It'd be funny if she did that to Caroline Kennedy. Yeah, I'm going to need the cash.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I like Carol as much as you guys, but I'm going to need to see the cash.
Yeah, don't give me a check.
I hope she had good security.
Who's gonna fuck with Aretha?
Yeah.
And she's also, gonna, I think she had a knife in her bra too.
You never know.
I bet her boobs were not that big. That was just all cash.
This is all cash.
That was just cash. Talk all about bought and paid for. Yeah.
And then, you know, she had I just saw the clip, the Divas Live where sang with all she sang with all of them singing Natural Woman, and it was very nice.
And but Celine Dion wouldn't shut up.
Yeah, but it's like a year later that she lost her damn mind because she tried to do a duet with Mary J. Blige. And I don't know if she felt threatened, but she just shit all over Mary J. Blige. And it was just so awful to watch of like just listen to your partner sing and sing the song. And then to watch that and like, oh, they're that's a year before that she let all those other women sing her song. Right. She learned that lesson.
Yeah. So on that story of the first one, the Divas
with all of them,
And the, so I guess the scandal there was, and she just probably gets in his zone, they had their parts. And there's the part where then Celine Dion's supposed to sing, but Aretha was before that, and she just kept going because she like found the joy.
Jesus,
and so Celine Dion was like trying to like out sing her, and she was just like, no, that's not going to happen.
Sorry, skinny white girl.
And I know, and it's just like so pathetic.
And
like,
if you watch it, she's just singing her own song,
right?
Like she's just ripping on stuff, but she just starts to ignore them.
I know that people love to rip Mariah Carey, but I've always liked her, so I'm going to defend her because when you watch
it,
Mariah Carey's smart enough to see it happening, so she just stopped singing.
She does.
She probably wasn't singing over anyway. But
yeah, I'm good. Yeah. Aretha, because she does her part. She sings her little, because her and Gloria Estefan share a verse. And that's all they get is their one shared verse.
Right.
And then Mariah and Gloria and Carole King just sing the back. They just harmonize with the backup singers. They're not trying to add anything, although Mariah could.
She
went and they just started doing the backup singer, and it got funny to watch because Celine is trying to like
she's doing all that
she's trying to do the whole camel toe cam
and Mariah
all
looks
shit.
Over at it and she's like no.
And Mariah's got that ridiculous
that big hair.
Okay, she looks like a cartoon character.
I'm gonna go home and watch that again. It's so good.
I thought it was I saw Carrie Gordy on CNN. I'm assuming that it's Berry Gordy's kid, but I don't know. The president of Paisley Park Records and was talking about
Which is
Aretha.
Weird because then you go through Prince to get there and through Minnesota.
Oh, yeah.
But and it's even the strange thing is that she was from Detroit, came up, but she went through Columbia Records like Barbara Streisand. Like she never went for that.
Kerry Gordy is the son of Berry Gordy.
Son, okay.
He was telling a story, so I kind of took it back to Janet Jackson and where she, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
Yeah.
Right. And he was telling the story. He said that he thought that the story embodied who she is, that the current COO of his company was an agent at William Morris. And one day, this gal was a junior agent at the time, and she was sitting at a desk when Aretha called. And Aretha says hello, and she says, "Oh, hi, Aretha." And Aretha's like, "Wait a minute. Do you know me? Do I know you? You call me. You refer to me as Ms. Franklin, not Aretha. I want my respect." And he says, and I think that she embodied the song, like just in general, that everything that was just about her embodying respect. And so it made me think of Janet.
Yeah. And that's but the shitty tell-all about Diana Ross.
And Diana, Miss Ross.
Call her Miss Ross. And the fact that some of the girls that knew her from the neighborhood when she was Diane would like just a fuck with her. Call her Diane. Like,
and the most passive aggressive thing that I absolutely love is Mary Wilson's biography. And of course, it is her because her real name is Diane. It's not Diana.
Yeah. I
didn't know that.
Her name is Diane Ross. And they had the falling out with Mary Wilson. So that is her actual name. So it's half passive aggressive and half not, but I loved it. For the entire book, she never once refers to her as Diana. It's Diane the whole fucking time. Even at the when she's the biggest star.
That's great.
She's like, and she does it in a way, even when she's saying nice things, she's like, and Diane was like, just Diane.
Just to get in.
Don't you know Diana Ross wanted to fucking kill her?
Oh, I'm sure. That was the but she did that like a thing. Betty Davis
No, she was just bitter because she felt that they were inducted. Their year for induction came up when they were the Supreme, so it was 25 years. It wasn't until a couple years later that they became Diana Ross and the Supremes.
And the Supremes, okay.
So the induction couldn't... It has to be 25 years from your first recording. They were the Supremes.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't induct them as Diana Ross and the Supremes, even if they wanted to, because that would be considered like a different group, and they would have to wait 25 years till then.
Got it.
So then she kind of wanted to be inducted again as Diana Ross and the Supremes.
Okay.
And her solo time has come up, and I don't think she's even ever been nominated as a solo artist.
Okay.
But so she was shitty about going in as the Supremes and not Diana Ross and the Supremes. But there's rules, you know.
Of course. Weren't there like
but the
kind of
are you talking about the Caller Miss Ross part? That was just
she made the
help
the
caller.
Feud,
that.
Because
that's,
the feud.
That's where the
feud. Yeah. Oh, because she Diana Ross was a bitch.
Yeah. No, I know, but
that's
why.
That was one of the falling outs of her because Mary Wilson thought it would be a great idea for them to get back together and possibly tour.
Okay.
And it would start with
I recall when they did that.
And it was this the induction was to be the start of we can make a fortune if we go and tour as the Supremes.
Sure. Yeah.
Because Cindy Birdsong is still alive.
And Florence
the replacement
Ballard.
Dead.
Got it.
Super dead.
So they, you know, they wouldn't have to go with the bad blood with Florence Ballard. They could use Cindy Birdsong. And
I just thought
fine.
It was kind of a I
Florence
just kept
Ballard
wanting
who died
to say
in a poorhouse.
Faye Dunaway, but not you know, but
right.
See, I just, it doesn't matter. I'm a bad gay person.
So I mean, but that's so there's all
you drive a Subaru,
blood.
You're doing your part.
Thank
but
you.
That was the that's public feud was over the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame,
right?
Because
right.
she was real. She was a
Joan
shitty...
Crawford. For the love of Christ!
Oh my God! I didn't know where you were going.
Okay, I didn't know she was just screaming out names. So
no, Betty Davis and Joan Crawford, like their kind of feud.
Oh, that's that was a major league one.
But they were on good terms right at like pretty
up
much until then, and then Mary Wilson was like.
Yeah,
you know.
Fuck you.
And Cindy Birdsong could always go back to LaBelle because that's where they poached her from the Bluebells.
Mini Aretha.
Yeah. No, but. What?
I'm kidding.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and then the fun of Fox News.
Fox News.
Fuckers.
Aunt Jemima.
We're still in the entertainment section. Yeah. I don't know if you know that.
Damn.
But continue on.
So. All right, so now we have to go with, and
there's
I can't find.
There's your Aretha, Nero.
Okay, so a sad. another truly tragic death. Well. We'll just die out tragic when we see how old he was.
I have absolutely no idea.
But Craig Sedan, one of film and television's most prolific producers of musical, has died. He was 69, and I have told you all for years, when Neil and Craig make something, you just show up.
Okay.
They did all the revivals in the 90s of Broadway musicals for ABC. They did Annie. They did they never got to Guys and Dolls. They did Annie. They did The Music Man. And they took the musicals and put them back in their original form to make up for horrible movie versions of said things.
Oh, okay.
They famously did Chicago. They did Hairspray. So following shoulder replacement surgery. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
On behalf of his life partner, Eldwood Hopkins, and his producing partner, Neil Marone, we are stunned that the man behind so many incredible films, theater, and television productions, several of them joyous musicals, were taken away so suddenly. So this is young and tragic. Craig's distinguished career as a passionate and consummate producer is eclipsed only by his genuine love for thousands of actors, directors, writers, musicians, designers, and technicians he worked over the years. His absence we felt in our hearts and throughout the business. And this is someone that I have been, these two I have been pushing for years.
Mm-hmm.
If they do some, Gypsy was their how they started. Bette Midler in Gypsy. They wanted a filmed version of Gypsy where the person playing Gypsy Rose Lee could, not Gypsy Rose Lee, but Mama Rose could sing.
Okay.
So they got together with Bette Midler and The Wonderful World for CBS. I'm sorry, that one was for CBS. And then they did Cinderella with Brandy. They did the revivals of How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying with Matthew Broderick, Promises. And my favorite story about them, they earned 6 Academy Awards, 5 Golden Globes, 17 Emmy Awards, 2 Peabody Awards,
two
a Grammy Award,
jeez.
6 GLAAD Awards, 4 NAACP Image Awards, and 2 Tony Awards.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Amazing. But one of my favorite stories of him, and he is the one that got us the gay, the Cup of Christ. What's that called?
Wine?
The Holy Grail.
The Holy Grail. He got the gay Holy Grail.
Joan Crawford.
Right, Jesus.
Because he was having, and I don't remember which one, I'm going to confuse whether it was Neil or Craig, but I think it was Craig, tells the story of, as a child, being in the Broadway audience of the filming of Liza with the Z. He grew up, became friends with Liza Minnelli, was having dinner at her house, he and Craig and their partners were having dinner with Liza, and they were talking about the, how much they loved Liza with the Z, and she was like, you know, I own the rights to that. Mm. And they were like, what?
Yeah.
How is, like, the greatest filmed musical live concert in, like, television history sitting unwatched, and you own the rights? How do you own the rights? And she was like, no one's ever asked about it. I don't know. So they brought it to Showtime, they brought it to CBS, they brought it to Viacom, and they sold it, and after 30 years, it only played twice on television. Yeah, it was never repeated. It was never available on video. They did this breathtaking, and it still looks fake. He's seen it. I think you've seen it. It looks like she's lip-syncing. Like, it doesn't look technically possible because they were able to punch up the sound so well that you can't believe that it's a live performance.
Happening. Yeah.
But, and truly genius. And it was their gift. And they said, they knew. They were like, we are going to make so many gay men happy right now.
Yeah.
That Liza with this Z that
stroke.
You've always wondered what is happening. Because the musical Fosse, when they were putting together things to put into the musical Fosse, they stole from Liza with the Z a few times, but people were like, well, how would we know if this is real? Like, no one's, there's only a few people that have seen it or people that saw it in the 70s before there was any way to tape it or anything. So it just didn't exist. There weren't even bootleg copies. Like, there was no way to find it. Okay. And just this dinner with saying he was a fan and he was in the audience.
That's fantastic.
And to find out that Liza didn't have to fight anybody, like, you know, I own the rights to that.
No contractual.
Yeah, gays around the world lost their mind. And I mean, everybody was there when that fucking shit came out because I made everybody watch that. Okay, so we'll go through a couple more things. Funny story, death in marriage. Winona Ryder says she and Keanu Reeves got married during Dracula. And now Francis Ford Coppola, but I don't think he directed that. I can't remember who directed that version of Dracula. Well, in Romania, while filming the movie, because the director, somebody's got to look up the director for me. Oh, in that scene, Francis Ford Coppola, I was right, used a real Romanian priest.
You're welcome.
We shot the master and did the whole thing, so I think we're married, because when they tried to do the ceremony, he thought it looked fake. So he was like, let's shoot a real traditional wedding, and then we'll edit it out so it'll look more real, because he didn't like the way they staged it. So they actually had a ceremony, but
that's fascinating.
So people are saying, like, they probably didn't use their real names. They would have used their characters' names, and they never signed a piece of paper afterwards. But in the eyes of the church, they
are married.
Married.
Oh, wow. I love that.
Like, their characters are married.
No, no, but, like, religiously, those
they
two
are married.
Under a different name.
Because you don't say your name. You just say, I do.
I do.
You
like,
don't
say
that's
name.
Right.
Yeah, you don't say, so, you say, Kim, do you take this person? Yeah.
So legally, they're probably not married because they never signed anything. But who knows what the fuck they do in Romania.
In the eyes of God, they are.
Right, but that's Francis Ford Coppola came out and said, oh, you know, she might be right.
And Keanu Reeves came out and said, what?
What?
No.
She Keanu stole Reeves my heart.
So get Keanu Reeves said, oh, my God, I think we're married.
That's awesome.
Well, weren't they? Oh, no.
Who was Johnny Depp.
Johnny Depp.
That's right.
I'm like, who got I Love Wine or whatever. That so it's just so this funny story going on around the internet. And it sounded like yet another crazy story. And then you find out everybody's backing her up like, oh, my God, that was
That's
real.
True.
Like, we did the whole ceremony.
I don't care that she shoplifted. I love her.
She's a twitchy mess. I enjoy her.
Really
she was in Heathers, and that's all you need to know. That redeemed her forever.
Oh, and she's so good and straight. Because now here's my theory on that one.
Here we go.
She is playing the Heathers character who watched a high school almost get blown up and her boyfriend get killed as the adult in Stranger Things.
It's just the
grown-up Heather. She's a nervous fucking train wreck of a human who has seen teenagers do terrible things to each other.
That's the greatest theory ever.
It is. It's right up there with the true story of the dead lady who...
And Reba being a man.
That's the dead lady. Okay. We're gonna race to the rest of this because not a real thing. That's not a real thing. That's not a real thing. Okay, so let me see. I think there's something I'm obsessed with. Hold on. Stay there. I don't write things down in the same place.
I wonder who they're gonna perform for Reba on Kennedy Center Honors. I mean, are they gonna
a man? I think.
Are they gonna dig up old Patsy Cline and have her come out and do little?
Kelly Clarkson.
Kelly Clarkson. I think Dolly might come out and do something. I could see that.
What about Carrie Underwood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I could see that.
True. Well, that was exciting.
And then someone fancy.
That was a thrill.
Someone fancy.
Okay, so because I gave up the solitaire game, I decided after finishing the Versace miniseries, which just terrific.
Yeah.
And really what good happens when you just put Ryan Murphy's name on something and let someone else take over. Like, that really doesn't go astray. But I was curious about a couple things that I thought, well, that's too outlandish to be true, when it turned out they were actually true.
Yeah.
So now I'm reading the book called Vulgar Favors, written by Vanity Fair.
Marie North.
Yep. An article that was lengthened into this book. So well researched. And interviews with everybody. But again, with the bias, like, she's clearly... Well, I don't know if she clearly is, but she writes this as a judgy homophobic bitch. Like, yeah, it does not.
Because that's the 90s.
Oh, it is real. And it's after watching The Staircase and watching those people with the, you know, he was bisexual, doesn't make him a murderer. Like, settle down.
Right.
Okay.
They do not equate. And oh, but to read about the 90s in San Diego, when I was kind of in San Diego with Harrison a lot in the 90s.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And I mean, the bars, the people, the bartender's names. Like, some of these people are like, oh, a little too close to home. Like,
isn't that eerie to read, like, a place that you were at and a person that was there, and it's in a book you're reading? You're like,
and it's not like, oh, this story took place in, like, Gilbert, and
that
I live in Phoenix.
Yeah. Familiar.
Yeah. You're this takes place at the front bar at Flicks, and at Rich's, and they lived on Vermont, they lived on Richmond, and they lived on Washington, and who the apartments were. And then they brought up the Wussy Pussy, the West Coast production company over by the warehouse district by the airport downtown, that was called the Wussy Pussy with all the drugs.
Yeah. We went. You and I went there together.
Yeah. Harris and I used to go to the Wussy Pussy every time I was out there, and one time screamed.
I just appreciate you continuing to say Wussy Pussy.
Because that's what it was called.
No, I know, but I'm just loving that. That's fantastic.
Because, you know, when she said West Coast, I was like, what the fuck is she talking? I'm like, oh my God, the West Coast production company, like the Wussy Pussy. I'm like,
bar I ever went to in San Diego.
If you did your research, the second thing you would have heard them say is what it was called. But as she's describing the bar, I'm like, oh my God, I have flashbacks about this place. But kind of like condemns all of us as being crack addled, like
deviants.
That there's nothing but gym bunnies and crackheads, and that's all San Diego is. And then it's just such a small knit community.
She watched the video Physical a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it was.
I wonder what she would say about it now if asked.
I think there's parts of it that I think
she would dial that back.
Oh God,
things are written in the context of the time, and that homophobia was much more just.
And she was doing a story about somebody who
was a drug
dealer.
Remember the news? I'm sorry to interrupt you. The news coverage of that was also terrible.
Yeah.
I apologize, like Marnie
I know,
said.
Exactly.
I
the apology was
But the
real.
News coverage was that same way.
Yeah.
It was like, homosexual Andrew Cunanan. You know, I was like, good Lord, you know. Right. That's the gay part doesn't have anything to do with it.
But it did for how they treated the crime, and the fact that the one victim they thought was the murderer, and so they didn't go looking for the airports. They never went looking for De Silva, Cunanan, whatever name he was going by. They never went looking for him because they just assumed that because Cunanan showed up with a bag of steroids, probably to sell, because that's what would sell in that area. He was going to someone who worked out all the time and was recently into bodybuilding. Like, maybe he could help him sell these illegal steroids. They assumed they were the murder victims, and that he was on a roid rage and killed somebody over a lover's triangle. And then someone they interviewed told them that they thought that the one guy, David, had given Andrew HIV. And so, I mean, it just turned into this filthy story of them not. And that's why it's called the largest failed manhunt in U.S. history.
No shit.
Because they were always behind.
Across
and always
the whole
doing
country.
And isn't that weird as a gay man thing, and they were always behind?
Oh, my God.
Well, there you go.
Drop the mic.
Knocking on the back door. So.
Knocking on the back door.
Good night,
Phoenix.
Good night.
That's
Phoenix.
So, once you get over the tone that she uses to paint all of us
in this
drug addled haze, but she really is interviewing all the right people and getting the stories.
And she's a good writer.
She's a very, very good writer. And it's just that bias that, especially after watching The Staircase, where they keep making different documentaries and changing the bias, that you're like, well, now whose side are you fucking on?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, now this whole thing makes these people look dirty when the guy that you just said told me was a murderer is innocent, but she spent 6 fucking hours telling me the guy killed everybody. So it's just funny to watch something so biased into like, oh, it's this subset of dirty people, but isn't it fascinating to read that they had lives and loves? I mean, it just, there's an ick quality that you just... Oh, you just can't get...
That's what I don't like about a lot of true crime fiction, which surprises some people that I don't really follow a lot of it, because it's so exploitative, if that's the right word, exploitation, that I don't always like it. It's too, like, look at those people. I'm like, and a lot of those times, people had families, that, and you're getting all geeked out over it.
And a lot of times the writer goes in with a bias, and if you feel the bias, you really don't trust the writer.
Yeah.
You feel like, what are you holding back?
Right.
But, I mean, honestly, she aside from the tone that she writes a lot of it in, it's well-researched. It takes everybody's point of view. The one cop, she tries to portray him as, she gives his side of the story where he was like, I was so worried about OJ, and I was so worried about how we were going to be perceived and what we were going to be accused of with this murder, that I wanted everything done by the book.
Yeah.
And they'll say, like, this is what the family said you said, and he instantly became the bad cop in the thing, and he's like, I don't, but perception being reality, he doesn't have that idea that he ever said any of these things to this family or why the family would be so mistrusting of him. But when the other cop was someone that they trusted, he was like, I just let them be the good cop. He's like, but I don't get why I'm doing this. And then the family tells you what he said out loud, and he's like, and he responds to it. She tells him, this is what the family said you said about their son. And it, like, and it's only a few years later. It's not like written now. The book was written, I think, in like 2001 or 2000. So it's only a few years have passed that he's like, maybe I did. I don't know. But it's so funny to see like the bias, and just the bias from so many different places of, one question about, well, who's this guy? You know, because there was no real connection between the two guys in Minneapolis, except for they both knew him, and they kind of took turns with the visit. But they weren't a couple. They weren't they weren't even really friends. Like, they just knew of each other because he would come to visit, and they would try to pawn him off because they were both done with him. Right. So it's very interesting. The Lee Miglin story is... it's crazy because they don't know what the connection is, and the connection might be the son, because the son lived in San Diego and was trying to be a movie star, and he that might have secretly been in that crowd.
And well, they unless it's not real, they show Lee Miglin at a party in the San Diego at the mansion of the guy. Like, they crossed paths there,
right? But they don't know. So that's the part that I'm currently reading. So as far as like the writing goes now, there is no connection, and there's a little part earlier where there's something to do with the but not the game show network, the home shopping network, where a lot of their bigwigs pass through San Diego. So they're like, is that the connection? But as far as I can tell, and like I said, I'm a little bit more than halfway through the book.
But his wife, he wasn't part of the home shopping network. No,
but he did the marketing for her.
I have to say, you this.
He ran the business part of it for her.
Marilyn Miglin.
Yeah.
So this blew my mind. So my battles with insomnia, right, that have been this ongoing thing that Al's been trying to help me with. Like 3:30 in the morning the other night, and I channel surf when I have insomnia. Sometimes I can't just even focus on a show. I just need whatever. And Home Shopping Club, and I clicked on it. Marilyn Miglin was on.
She is still working
it on there. I was just blown away. I was like, wow. So did you love Judith Light?
Oh, absolutely.
Wasn't she amazing?
Yes.
Now that you've seen it, we can talk
so
about
far,
it.
So far, like the description
I think she was
of...
the best part of that show.
Max Greenfield, I thought, was absolutely fantastic. And I liked...
she was just so good.
I liked the two boys in Minnesota. I thought Darren Criss's performance for 9 straight hours, or however long that was
crazy.
It's really well done.
She just brings it every time, though.
And she really does, because her part in that book is very... It's very short, and it's all about the finding the body and her, like, I'm going to keep this together...
Yeah.
Like, I'll cry when I have to cry, but the rest of the time, we are just going to get through this.
Right.
And the police reports say she said, like, she told the neighbors, he's dead. I know he's dead. They're never going to find the killers. And she wants, their house was always open. They didn't close drapes. They didn't close blinds. Mm-hmm. They were known for this big, white, spacious, open house. And the first thing she did as they're, like, trying to find the body and don't know what's going on, she opens the drapes. Mm. And they're like, you probably shouldn't touch anything. She's like, I don't care. They'll never find this guy.
Right. Wow.
So, you know, like, just, it's But
I cannot wait to read
For those of
and
you
it's
who,
a quick it's a quick read.
For those of you who have not seen it and may not understand who we're talking about, the wife, Marilyn Miglin, is the widow of one of the men that Andrew Cunanan had had murdered. So I'm going to show you this picture. So on the right is the actual Marilyn Miglin, and then on the left is Judith Light made to be Marilyn Miglin.
But thank you for finding that.
She is a character that Judith Light in anything is fantastic.
She just brings
it. But she played the shit out of that character in that movie.
Really did.
She's like a
and such dignity.
The TV.
It's like
Meryl Streep. Meryl Streep.
Yeah. No, there's no question. And I know I told you because this is a show none of you have ever seen on the because she's a top quality shows that she's been on. But she was on the reboot of Dallas. Which was really
a
terrible show, but
yeah,
I watched
really
it because I loved the hot lead guy who's now on the I forgot. Anyway, super hot. So that's the only reason that I watched.
It's irrelevant.
But when she's on it in that piece of shit show, it's like she's doing fucking King Lear. It's like this ridiculous character.
Right.
It's overwrought, overwritten nighttime soap opera, and she's selling it like
phenomenal.
A fucking Shakespeare.
Yeah. Well, and she made Ugly Betty. Like Ugly Betty was already good.
Yes,
she raised everybody's
game.
And
I forgot about
and
that.
And it didn't matter how silly they made the story.
We need to have
let
a
me just point out
her.
The fact that she was on Law and Order.
Yeah, she's. I mean, she's.
And who's the boss?
Yeah,
isn't that how she started?
Oh, we're, no.
Oh no,
One Life to Live.
One Life to Live.
Karen, the prostitute. One Life to Live.
That's right.
No, One Life to Live. She was ABC.
Oh, Lord.
So I mean, she's fantastic. And then I'll just say about a movie that's out right now. Please go see it. It is a study in like sex and craziness and the real stories of Hollywood. But Scotty Bowers. It's from a book called Full Service that he wrote a couple years ago. He was like the bartender pimp of Hollywood out of a gas station is my favorite part. The Richfield gas station on Hollywood Boulevard where he was like people were turning tricks in like the bathroom behind. All the stories about Walter Pigeon being gay. Absolutely true. Later outed. Cary Grant was like the worst kept secret in Hollywood.
Had all kinds of boyfriends that lived with him.
Well, he was Ori Kelly's first boyfriend, and then he moved on to, and I'm going to forget the gentleman's name that was his, Tyrone Power, maybe. I don't want to disparage his name, but his next partner photographed together constantly, and they were roommates.
Yeah.
They lived together.
Right.
Like bachelors do. You make
when
that
you're
much
rich.
Money, motherfucker, and you got a roommate. You're gay.
Yeah. Who's your buddy?
Who's your buddy?
Who's your buddy?
Well, that's surprisingly that's the recurring theme because this guy talks about his work. Scotty Bowers talks about his work
I'm laughing
experience,
at Marnie.
And he helps
her commentary.
He helps with a book about soldiers called My Buddy. Because that was his question. Who's your buddy? Who's going to get you through this trauma? And there's that war song, My Buddy. So I mean, just funny that you said that. Oh my God! So the stories are hysterical, and the
what's
worst
it called?
Part is called
it's Full Service.
Is the book? I can't think of what the movie's called. Scotty Bowers,
the movie's
blah,
out
Hollywood.
Now.
The movie's out. It's playing at the Valley Art.
All right.
And it's one of those things where like,
who's your
buddy? So
who's
you.
Your buddy?
Oh, and like, but there's so much dangerously wrong psychology from this man who acts, and he's 90 years old. He's still getting up on the roof, fixing his roof.
Wow.
He feeds the animals outside, which I scream during parts of. but then he goes and there's a lot of these hustlers from back in the day that are still alive. So people will be like, oh, you're just making this up. You're really ruining someone's life. And he's like, well, you want to go meet another hustler? And he goes and meets somebody who's got pictures of Hollywood stars in the wall. And he's like, my God, yeah, he had a big cock.
Right.
And then they'll show pictures of them. And they're like, oh, you're making it up. Well, here's these nude photographs.
Mm-hmm.
And then this actor, like, because he has houses. You're like, how do you have multiple houses in the Hollywood area? Because one of the actors left him his house.
Yeah.
And Corbin Burnson from L.A. Law is the actor who died's godson and wants the ad. I'm going to spoil this one part of the movie because it fucking killed me. So Corbin Burnson wanted the actor's ashes, and he wants to take them out on a boat and spread them into the Pacific. And Scotty Bowers is like, fuck no, he would have never gone for that. But the because he doesn't throw anything away, the ashes are in a car parked in someone's garage in the trunk where they've never moved since the guy who put them in the trunk of the car and then died. He has to go find them because somebody sold that one house. So now, and I'm like, Corbett Burnson's got to be watching this movie because part of it's about his godfather who he loves. And he's like, he really would have wanted his ashes thrown off the deck. And there's a hole in the deck that they never got fixed and the wife almost fell through and died. He just pours the ashes through the hole in the deck. And he goes, that's what he wanted.
Oh,
And then he gets a hose and sprays off.
That's fantastic.
Oh, my God. Like,
oh, my God. Is Corbett Burnson watching the
he's
giant
have a stroke.
Fuck you. God,
what is this movie called?
It's called, somebody's got to Google it. I need a Googler. Scotty Bowers. It's based on Full Service. Oh, Scotty Bowers and the Secret History of Hollywood. Documentary.
Did you see it at the Valley Art?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God. And, like, his stories of...
is it there now?
Yeah, right now. Katharine Hepburn.
Why are we here?
Yeah.
Right.
So
we're
George
going
Cukor,
tomorrow.
Who was a woman's director and was like openly gay, made it through, like never got touched by the gay scandal. He was arrested once and the studio was like, he makes money for us. Get him out of jail and we'll just forget the gay
Remember
part.
Gods and Monsters?
Yeah.
They referenced that.
So he had this pool with these orgies.
Saturday was for the straights and Sundays was for the gays.
So living on campus.
You can get behind that, Marnie.
Oh, yeah.
So George Cukor's house had two very famous people that lived there that most people thought lived together in sin. Oh, no, they didn't. Spencer Tracy lived in one of the guest houses, and Katharine Hepburn lived in another guest house where she was a lesbian.
Yeah.
Where Scotty Bowers was, because he was a full service pimp, but he didn't take any money. He just wanted people to meet and be happy.
Hmm.
He would trick on his own, and he still bartends. Like,
did they give him like
gifts? He
goes
to a party, 90 years old, carrying the ice into bartend at a party. Like, this movie's fucking bananas. Like,
how old is this current?
He's 90. Yeah, no, it just got made this year.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He's 90.
I heard about the book.
He's 91 years old. Oh, yeah, because Barbara Walters went nuts over about outing people after they were dead, and she didn't want to hear stories about Cary Grant. Well, it turns out everyone knew
Oh, my
he
God.
Was gay.
Right. Everyone knew Cary Grant was gay.
Except for Diane Cannon, who married him and had a kid with them.
Did they give him gifts, though? Or, like, they must have helped him out in some way, right?
Well, they left him houses and cars. He also was a hooker. He was also a hustler on his own. He just would arrange other people, but he wouldn't take a cut of their money. And he would tell these ex-GIs, like, well, 20 bucks is... I mean, literally, it's 20 bucks to get your cock sucked. Close your eyes, pretend it's a woman.
Well, sometimes
Makes
it still
cash.
Is.
Yeah. Bananas. Yeah. So... He has. Wait till
they
you
don't
see.
Suck the bananas out.
Wait till you see. Wait till you see him feeding the animals outside. Like wait till the shitty things he does with cakes. You're gonna die.
Does he talk about anybody like?
But anyway,
James Dean or Marlon Brando or any?
Oh
none of that. Okay, just wondering.
But he gets to just about everybody
asking
for a friend.
Yeah, because all the people that were out and like doing stuff are like the New York people. Because Marlon Brando was more of a New York.
Yeah,
they had their like acting thing. So it became a better rumor for Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy to
be living in sin.
Living in sin and saying that Spencer Tracy couldn't divorce his wife because she was Catholic.
Right.
And that they were having this affair but protecting his marriage because of Catholicism. That admitting that Scotty Bowers was fucking him while he was bringing women to Katharine Hepburn. And then it turns out the story that I vaguely remember, Ava Gardner and... Oh, the other one that Frank Sinatra were in love with. Neither one of them were interested in Frank Sinatra. They were sleeping with each other.
Oh, wow.
And the other people, the other hustlers that came to like hook them up and have three ways with them and have sex with them, they confessed to it, but he wouldn't give it up. He would not admit to the, I think it was called The Confidential, that was known for outing gays in Hollywood and ruining their career. Like they eventually ruined Walter Pidgeon and all these people. He wouldn't sign the document, but then he had pictures. And he's like, I knew these two. They were always fucking. It was, but Ava Gardner, the love of Frank Sinatra's life, he lost his fucking mind over it. She had no interest.
Zero.
She was sleeping with some blonde that
Vanity
I can't remember.
Vanity Fair has a great article. I want to say like 15 years ago.
Yeah,
we'll have to look
totally
in the archives of it. It's fantastic about Katharine Hepburn's family and her background. And it's titled like, you know, basically the biggest con job in the world is how she sold herself.
Big dyke.
No, like how she sold herself as this straight New Englander, uptight, whatever. And she was actually, her family was like a bunch of communists. And she's like a communist lesbian. They were like, that is the best like rebranding,
thing. The town that Justin and Kurt live in Hartford, that's where she's from. They have the Katharine Hepburn Museum there, and you can see, like, her school books and all that shit, and they have costumes from her movies and stuff. And I was like, I'm just, like, fascinated. I'm like, and they said, like, she even went on the air with Barbara Walters, used Barbara Walters to read a love letter for Spencer Tracy mm-hmm. that she wrote wow. herself mm-hmm. just to make it look like they had been in love. Just yeah. to, even at, like, 60 years old,
she was still
yeah. going to push that.
Pushing that sure. bullshit.
Sure. But she looked good in pants. I like those pants that she would wear.
Oh, good. I was. So that's this was a big entertainment week. Sorry, we had some deaths.
I'm waiting for you to tell
Clayton's
me it's over.
Clayton's got his hand
it
on
is
the
over.
Hey, I have one quick question. Sorry, yeah. forgive me. But what is happening with that show that's on HBO with Amy Adams?
Oh, Sharp Objects.
Oh my God, is that good.
So good.
One more episode.
I know. Well, I didn't see the one Sunday
it's
yet.
So good.
I can't, I can't.
Wait, yeah. We can't talk about that if you haven't seen Sundays.
No, please don't.
It's a total
but
turning
point. But I'm
saying,
point. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, it's we'll so talk about good. It. Well, it finishes this week. We will chat about it at length. Brilliantly, brilliantly done.
She's amazing.
Yeah, she's so good.
And that mom.
I know. Adora. So.
I had to text Al. I'm like, is she pulling out her eyelashes? Oh my God.
Wait until
she
you
is
see
a freak.
Sunday.
Fucking nuts.
Well, I just love it. That's all.
It's good.
Well, that really is enough of a show for this week. I feel like
well,
I have to figure
it.
Out a way to go see this movie out at Valley Art Theater.
No.
At some point. I'm
get
not sure
on
how we're gonna do that, but we'll figure it out. My gosh. Well, you never know who's going to be with us next week. Doug, you might be here.
I might
we
be.
Don't
yeah.
know. We never know
we
from
never know.
Week to week.
I like it that way.
Yep.
Yes. Thank you, everybody.
Now
in the
that
chat
I'm the paid
room.
Contributor. Yes. Yes. No,
and
I'm
it's
sorry.
All good.
Non paid contributor.
Amina, Nero, Joe. Exactly.
Oh, thanks, Amina.
Meow, Cal.
And
all of
Mama
Dad.
Thank
Jody.
All of you. Good yes. times. Yep. And Rock 100 yep. and Bridget in the YouTube room.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Just fantastic.
Oh my God, I'm
going to
need a
Clayton's going
to have a beverage
PTSD
after this.
I'm going to
make it. We'll be good. Well, as usual, as we wrap up tonight's show, let's leave you with this parting thought. We will see you next Tuesday.
It's enough for today. Spicy's going to go bye-bye right now. I need a big boy nap.